What is food security? Is food security something that everyone should be worrying about? Or is food security an issue only government needs to worry? In 2020, and in light of this COVID situation, personally, I think food security is everyone's business. The food security, as defined by the United Nations Committee on World Food Security, it means that all people at all times have physical, social, and economic access to sufficient, safe, and nutrition foods that meets their food preference and dietary needs for an active and healthy life. I know it's a lot of process, but this podcast is all about the growing, the making, the keeping, the storing, distribution, everything about food, but not just about the taste. Hi, my name is Ip, and welcome to the Functional Food Podcast. Is food security all about storing food? Or does having the ability to produce food form the golden benchmark? What is going on over in Singapore when it comes to this topic? Hi, welcome to the Functional Food Podcast, and I'm your host, Yip. This is a show where we explore the ideas of growing your own food, to producing meats from cells, and getting to speak with great minds in this space. Hope you enjoy the show. Every links and topics we speak about will be in the show notes. You can catch us on Spotify, Apple iTunes, Google Podcasts, and many, many more places where you normally get podcasts. Do subscribe and leave reviews as this helps in getting more content out. And without further ado, let's bring on today's episode. Hey everybody, welcome back to the Functional Food Podcast. I know it's been a while, but today we have a guest. Today we have Jackie DeVore from Food Tech Gen, which is a website that covers the latest trends, opportunities, and advancements in the food tech space. She's also a venture capital lawyer from the Big Apple, New York City. She is currently based in Singapore and also serves as a mentor for Big Idea Ventures, which is a food tech accelerator based in Singapore and New York City. So hey Jackie, thanks for coming in.
So honored to be here and really excited about the conversation today.
Thank you. So actually what sparked this guest onboarding today is I saw this video on Chinese News Asia, and it's talking about the local food manufacturers seeing up to 30% surge in their production demand since the whole COVID started. And I was thinking, you know, since it's manufactured food, I felt that the words impossible meats, beyond meats, you know, alternative proteins come to my mind. And we would like to talk about it and how this fits the puzzle of providing different avenues for food security. Mm-hmm. And maybe just start off with yourself. How would you define alternative protein, and must this be plant-based?
Yeah, it's a really good question, because I feel like this buzzword has been thrown around increasingly over the past year, especially with COVID, but a lot of people mm-hmm. don't really know what it is. Just taking a quick step back, in order to truly define what alternative proteins are, I think it's important to kind of lay the groundwork of why we're here today. People are usually drawn to alternative proteins for one of three main reasons, mm-hmm. you know, environmental concerns. You'll hear a lot of people talk about by 2050, our global food systems will need to meet the demands of more than 10 billion people who also be wealthier and also have access to more luxurious food choices than the people of today. So, you know, that requires a lot more land and water to produce the meat that they want to consume, and mm-hmm. also can lead to really bad effects on the climate. Another bucket that people are interested in alternative proteins is from a health and food safety perspective. And COVID-19 completely accelerated that. And then lastly, the third bucket is animal welfare. So our food system needs to change to address all of those challenges. And mm-hmm. a very important part of this will be adopting the new technologies and food products into the mainstream that address those issues. So alternative proteins is kind of an umbrella term used to describe types of meat substitutes. That's usually the way you'll hear it, alternative proteins. And there's three main buckets, mm-hmm. plant-based proteins. So that's kind of your impossible and your beyond meat. Then there's cell-based or lab-grown cultivated meat, which is more of the sci-fi angle that we can get into.
Yep.
And then finally, another type of protein that's also kind of coming into the forefront is insect protein. But yeah, I think those are kind of the large three buckets people would encounter alternative proteins. So it doesn't have to necessarily be plant-based.
Oh, okay. So personally, I have eaten Impossible Meat, and I think as a, I mean, I don't really call myself as a carnivore, but I mean, I do eat meat, and I think that Impossible Meat, it can really fool a person, and the taste is really great, actually. Like you can't, like unless you are having a beef burger side by side, you can't really tell the difference when you're
Oh, that's
eating,
so true.
yeah, by itself. But for Beyond, I'm not too sure of because Impossible made a very, very big marketing effort, and you know, like everybody knows that, you know, they have this the blood thing that they do, but Beyond doesn't really have the kind of the similar stuff, right? Like.
Yeah, that's right. And they're also, if you take a look at just from an ingredient perspective, they're quite different in terms of their formulation. So, Beyond Meat, it focuses on pea protein. They also have chickpea protein, if I'm not mistaken, and it's soy free. Whereas Impossible, their main protein source is soy, and they also use what's called the heme to get that blood effect and that like red color, and to make it more meaty in texture. So the products, I think, in my mind, like you said, are couldn't be diff more different. And it's really kind of what you're looking for as a consumer in terms of eating it. So I love Beyond Meat, but I use their ground beef product, and I make like ground beef tacos with it, and they're phenomenal. But I only eat Impossible Burgers, so I use the product based on my the different needs.
Right. So besides these two big names, are there any more interesting ones? Like it doesn't necessarily need to be maybe like as impactful as Impossible, but that's really interesting and maybe out of this, like you wouldn't even think of using this raw material. Do you have something like that?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's so many other companies out now beyond Beyond Meat and Impossible. And, you know, this is let's say set the stage for people. Beyond Meat started was founded by Ethan Brown back in 2009. The space was not crowded at all, and they were really the first pioneers in creating this new category. So when they went public back in 2019, they truly set a flag in the ground that this market was legitimate and here to stay. You've seen a number of companies come onto the scene after that, and the opportunity in Asia specifically is huge. So I do, since we're in Singapore, I'd love to talk about some cool companies based here. So Kirana is markets itself as an Asian comfort food made from plants, and they focus on the use of jackfruit. And it's a company based here in Singapore, and they actually recently raised $1.7 million. So they're a company that's kind of really moving fast. Another one that I think is interesting, I'm not sure if you've tried it, but Omnipork. They're based out of Hong Kong. They're started by a guy named David Young. He's the founder of Green Monday and Green Common. And Omnipork is a plant-based pork product that has really been impactful in the Asian market. Because, you know, contextually, I think burgers are usually more, I guess, resonate more in North America and even Europe. But I think in Asia, pork is kind of the dominant meat buyer, and that you have like your applications of it there, so not necessarily burgers. And so Omnipork really found a really great space in the market for them to launch, and they manufactured out of Thailand, so the price is incredible. It's actually cheaper in some instances than buying ground pork, so that's a really cool company people can watch out for.
So I've been looking around in the supermarket freezers, and I realized that they put things like Impossible and Beyond onto the vegetarian section.
Right, which is not what they want.
But the thing about Asia is, or even actually Singapore, we do have a section, the vegetarian section that has fake meat, mock meat they call it, but it's nowhere near the sophistication of Impossible and Beyond. So usually they're made out of things like beancurd or even like flour to mimic the texture and the not taste but more of just the look of the meat. So like for some I don't know, have you had it before? Like on the 25th of every month there will be a group of usually Buddhists, they will go and have vegetarian meals, and yeah,
No, I've not.
and this vegetarian stores, they actually have the normal veg like cabbage and stuff, and then they also have the mock meats.
Got it.
Yeah, and it's a variety though. That is a mock kidney, mock goose meat, mock cashew. I think that's about it. There's quite a few selection, which is a bit mind blowing. I mean, when we are talking about alt protein, like we think like only coming from overseas, coming from America, but actually mock meat has already been around, and I think this concept, if done right, actually it will take off really, really fast. You know, especially there's a very hardcore group of vegetarian. They're non-vegetarians, but they eat specifically this sort of meals on certain days.
Right, right. So I think that's actually a really good point that is worth exploring a bit, because like you said, plant-based proteins have been around for centuries in Asia. Like, you know, and you have even people, tofu, seitan, but they've been within the context of either religion, so Buddhists, or just other kind of more fringe groups than mainstream. And I feel like now plant-based proteins are almost being remarketed as a completely new product and different category entirely. And so with that, then I think there has to be conversation about like consumer education, getting to the fact that, okay, well, this is kind of what we've been eating all along, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily anything too controversial, and it's something that people have a familiarity with here. You just have to remove the stigma of, oh, it's only for, you know, religious holidays, I'm going to eat this, or only for that, but it's something that you can incorporate into your daily lifestyle.
Yeah, I mean, this is much more easier to market than, say, insects, even. Have you tried before insects?
I have. So actually, in Mexico, they're quite big, so I have definitely eaten some fried up ants before. Quite good.
Yeah, if you want to be adventurous, just avoid the water beetles.
Why?
So the problem with bugs, right, is as long as they're on land, dry land, they're fine. Mm-hmm. But once they're in the water, it's a bit dubious. Like I felt that.
Have you tried it? I've tried.
When I was in Thailand, I've tried the whole range. Mm-hmm. I mean, whatever that was available on the shop. I had the grub is nice, the ones that eat the tree, the insides of a tree, the big fat ones that you normally see on TV, those are good.
I know, I have it in my mind right now, exactly what you're talking about.
Those are great. It's like a bit custardy, it's like a dessert, it's great. But the water beetles, those are the worst. Like, they taste exactly where they come from.
Say no more. But that, so that's like, though, we were talking earlier about like what kind of constitutes an alternative protein. So proteins are really, you know, coming to the front of the stage. But there's two main problems with that people have. One is what you're talking about right now, cultural appeal. Will people even want to eat something that they know it's an insect, because there's some stigma about insects and, like, you know, on the ground, or I don't know, it's gross, whatever. And then the second, too, is people don't necessarily, some people don't consider it to be vegan, because obviously you're killing and harvesting insects. So from animal welfare standpoint, some people don't even, they see it as being controversial. But you know, the pros of it is that they're super cheap to produce and they're minimally processed, because insects can be reared on animal feed that's unsuitable for livestock use.
Yes.
And so what otherwise would have been wasted or have low economic value, now you can kind of turn to this application, and actually it's quite cost effective.
So, I mean, this podcast is all about food security. And so do you think with a, like in Singapore context, with a national policy and the ability to synthesize alternative protein, do you think this will be a core or even maybe a vital part in the future food security?
Oh, I think 100%. I mean, taking a step back for people who don't know the statistics, Singapore sometimes faces challenges because of its dependence on foreign imports, right?
Yes.
The figure is the country imports about 90% of its food supply. That balance with, it's important to make sure that everyone in Singapore has access to safe, nutritious food that's also affordable. So that's where it can kind of get tricky. So Singapore's 30 by 30 vision is incredible, because they're aiming to get that number down to 30% of its food supply being homegrown, with a primary focus on seafood and leafy green vegetables. So Singapore is an interesting case study, because there it's a country where the government is 110% on board to find any way to diversify its local food supply and make sure that it's sustainable, not just in the short term when you have national crises like COVID-19, it's a perfect example, but also in the long term as well. And so, you know, I think about this a lot. I'm sure, you know, do you remember exactly when the alert level went to orange here? I feel like everyone rushed to the supermarket, stockpiling pasta, rice, toilet paper. It was complete panic because people were concerned that their food would run out. So, you know, we really saw real life in front of us.
Yes.
For people to feel food insecurity and to feel like they don't know if they'll be able to have access to food for a while. And so I think that really also kind of accelerated Singapore government's you know, commitment to the mission of making sure that they're supporting these endeavors, including alternative protein, to make sure that, you know, their citizens feel secure.
Yeah, I mean, embarrassingly, I was one of those people that rushed out to.
I was too. I'm raising my hand. I was too.
and I went a step further. I actually drove, me and my wife, we drove to Malaysia.
Really?
And we wiped their stuff out from the shelf. I kid you not, that day we spent, I think, close to $1,000 of groceries.
What'd you go for?
My wife was really, you know, she wants to buy a lot of the antibacterial kind of stuff. And then I told her, just get the bleach, get the nonsense. We want the frozen stuff, you know. And she went and get herself all those premium toilet paper.
Yeah, I mean, I did the same. So I, and you know, there's this weird feeling of feeling shame about it because some people were judging you if you were stockpiling. But, you know, especially being in a completely new country for me, I just felt I have no idea what might happen. And so I got a couple huge bags of brown rice, a lot of pasta and pasta sauce, and more toilet paper than I needed, that's for sure.
Oh, you do have to look out for your stockpile pasta though. Like, we have some from Malaysia that is, there are bugs in it, they're weevils.
What?
Yeah, I think they were on the shelf for too long and, you know.
No way.
Yeah, so we keep.
That's your insect protein.
So now we keep all our dry pastas in the fridge.
Huh.
Yeah.
Now I'm getting nervous. I'm going to have to check out my pasta stockpile after
Look out for holes in the packaging. The weevils can punch through the bags.
Oh, interesting. My skin is crawling.
So,
but yeah, I think, what's the word? And is it in Singlish? It's fear of, is it kiasu? Or what was the word?
Kiasu.
Mm-hmm. Kiasu, yeah.
You kind of pronounce the K and the A and I through your nose. Kiasu.
Kiasu.
Yeah.
Well, this isn't a podcast about hearing me learn how to speak English, so I'll move on. But yeah, I remember hearing that word and I completely understood. Getting back to the food security question,
yes.
It truly was a fear. Some might say irrational because everything obviously turned out fine from a, you know, being able to, for us to go to the grocery store and buy food. No one ran out from that sense, but it was this irrational fear of, I just need to grab everything I can because I have no idea what's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to my wife about it and I told her, it's a wartime now. I mean, we need to have enough food that we could eat for at least a month. So if ever need to, we need to stay in the house and just not go out. You know, at least we are able to survive. But of course, thanks to the policies that we have, the deliveries were actually exploding, and the restaurants are actually a hidden front line, vital to this disease because they were the ones providing the food.
Oh, 100%. I think, and it's really important you bring that up because I think they really go under the radar.
Yeah.
But they were exactly at the front lines, making sure everyone had access to food and also fresh food, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I still ordered sushi, query where that seafood was coming from. But, you know, it's like the world didn't stop. And so I think Singapore is trying to make sure that, you know, at the worst point in a recent history of a national crisis and pandemic, if they're able to sustain its po their population in that sense, you know, how can we take this even further, reduce our reliance on imports, and kind of really, you know, diversify local production and make sure that, you know, we're always going to be good.
Yeah, I mean, when I saw the news initially where they talk about there's enough for everyone, I was really skeptical about it because when I look at the shops, there's nothing, you know. And then you have the news saying that, oh, it's coming, it's coming, it's coming. It's like, no, it's not. But actually, it is. It did. Everything came.
It was touch and go for a little bit. I remember still being panicked that I couldn't find hand sanitizer anywhere. And then, like, magically one day, 7-Eleven just had them. So, were you do you remember in 2018, I was reading about this, that there was a time when Malaysia threatened to limit the imports of eggs and seafood. So I guess, I don't know, it probably wasn't as similar to a degree as COVID, but even then, the Singapore government's handled these challenges before, and, you know, are quite comfortable saying we have enough. So I think, at least from a public policy perspective, they're doing a great job of reassuring everyone here that it's going to be okay.
Yeah, I mean, like eggs is a big issue in Singapore. So apparently, for some reason, like so when I was in Australia, I don't eat that much eggs as I do in Singapore, but the eggs there are a lot better though. But
Really?
yeah, I mean, I grew my
Easter.
own eggs. So you know, I knew where my chick what my chickens are eating, and the yolks are always, you know, bright orange. I can never get the same consistency here in Singapore. Like no matter what brand I try, there's always this, it always feels lacking. Like some nutrients is not in their diet, you know what I mean? Or maybe active, they can't, they're mostly, most of the chickens here are, they call it the factory style, you know, they're in the cages. Whereas the ones I had in Australia was free ranging. So I let them out in the day. And they do whatever. I don't know where they went, but they'll come back.
They went to have a cocktail. But
But
what did you feed them? I'm curious, because that's a really important part of it as well. That also goes into the cell-based meat conversation. We can get into it, is you're still feeding the cells. So the diet of, you know, whether it's an actual live animal or you're growing it on your own in the lab, is important what you're putting into it.
So for my chickens, I was doing a mixture of crushed oyster shells that I get from like a trash product, and then I feed them seeds that I sprouts, and also just regular feed when I'm too lazy to do anything. But this is not their main diet. This is it's like a breakfast to them, and then the rest of the day they're just eating whatever that's out there.
Yeah, it's so interesting to me because, like you said, I've noticed a difference too. Not the eggs as much, but the produce for sure. I feel like, and I so I did an experiment, and I looked went to the supermarket, and I just wanted to see how many like, let's say, leafy green vegetables were actually made in Singapore versus how many were imported. And there was only one brand that was locally grown. Everything else was imported. So already, from a shelf life perspective, you're getting these greens that have probably been plucked a few weeks ago. And so when I take them home, I was getting so frustrated because they would go bad so quickly in my fridge. It's super expensive. But now there's a lot more companies starting in Singapore, either hydroponic or indoor farming, that, you know, promise you really clean, really healthy, and really fresh vegetables, which is, I think, really needed. So hopefully the egg train also picks that up too.
So, you were mentioning cellular meat production. I have this in my mind that so have you watched Star Trek before?
Star Trek? My husband tried to get me to watch it. I'm not. This is gonna probably make your viewers mad for the people who really love it. Star Wars and Star Trek kind of seem the same to me. I know that's a huge controversial statement, but I totally.
You just need to remember Star Wars is like it's like a elf and orcs, and then Star Trek is more of scientists.
Oh, Yoda. Okay, I know Yoda.
So in Star Trek, they have so it's on Netflix right now, the Star Trek's Enterprise. So is somewhere it was filmed in the 90s, and the timeline of this Star Trek show was is at the beginning of early contact with the Vulcan. So it's a very it was still very crude, and unlike you know like the ones you've seen in the movie, those are more advanced already, like further in the timeline. So in this timeline, they only had this thing called a protein sequencer. So they rearrange protein molecules to become the meat that you want to eat or whatever food you want to eat.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, but they have a very limited recipe. Like they can only do a few combinations. So they can do a burger, they can do a steak, but they can't do anything complex. Like you want to eat a Chinese dim sums, for example, they can't do it. They can only do the basic stuff. So in this sense, cellular production, it how does it like? Is it as sci-fi as Star Trek, where it just appears out of a light beam, or is it a very long and painful process of growing in a petri dish?
Right. I mean, it's actually a perfect example because right now, we call them founders, entrepreneurs, but they're truly scientists that are working through the problem of they're only able to create tiny, tiny pieces of meat and also in very specific applications. So it's not like they can say, oh, I want you to grow me like a T-bone steak. That's going to take years and years of research and development and also understanding how to actually mimic that process inside an animal in the lab. So I think we're far ways away from that. But what companies are able to do right now is create like filler meat that usually would go into like your chicken nuggets or like being smashed together into a burger. So that's easier for them to kind of tackle. Seafood is also a huge one that I think will be the first commercially available cell-based meat, just because the way it looks already, the texture, the taste, it's easier for scientists right now to go ahead and get that out versus if you want me to grow you a steak. That's going to be really difficult in a number of different ways. But for people who don't know what cell-based meat is, I think I mentioned it earlier, but you truly are, you're not killing the animal at all. So it's marketed as being slaughter-free or what people call clean meat. And so you're taking a tiny biopsy cell sample from the animal and you're putting it into a cultivator or bioreactor and you're literally feeding it and growing it inside this confined space, just like it would grow inside the animal until it becomes like the full form muscle. The rub is, number one, it's incredibly expensive, right? So, I mean, the first lab-grown burger was, I think, in 2013 by who the guy who was affiliated with Mosa Meat. I think it was a couple $100,000. I don't know, something crazy. And then also, it's really hard to scale. So they're only doing this in like individual instances. So that's obviously not a company that'll be globally known if you can't produce enough burgers to feed even all of Singapore, right? But yeah, I mean, I think one day we will get to a place where they'll be able to scale to the fact that you can say, I want a pork sausage and I want a burger and I want, I don't know what else you would say, like ground beef and all that, and like on a steak, and I want lamb chops and ribs. I think we'll get there.
I think I believe I saw a news maybe a few weeks, a few months back about this Japanese company envisioning that meat will be grown in the houses, like as though you plant the vegetables on the in the pot, you know, like next to the window. You'll be as easy as
And
that.
Integriculture, you're referring to that company. It's an incredible, it's founded by a guy named Yuki Hanyu. It's one of my favorite companies to watch because he has such a beautiful vision that all open source as well. So he's not trying to be proprietary with his knowledge. He literally set up a foundation called the Shojin Project to share everything they're learning with other players in the space. Yeah, you're right. He did this project where he gave a mini bioreactor to like I think 16-year-old high school students in Japan to teach them how they could grow their own meat. So I think we'll could get to a place like that too, where you and I could just say, "Honey, I'm home. Have you grown our burgers for dinner tonight?"
Yeah, I guess this will take a because even today in 2020, like a hydroponic solution for a home, it's still being like developed left and right. Like you go to Kickstarter, there's always a new hydroponic solution, and there's no single like you don't think about the microwave anymore, do you? Like a microwave is a microwave, but
Exactly.
we haven't come to a stage where growing plant, even growing plants, like we haven't come to a stage where it is a thing, you know? Like there is so many solutions, but there is not a thing where you just go out and grab one and just put in the house. Like we haven't come to a point. So I think for, you know, things like cellular-based alternative protein, like I think it's going to take a long, long while before it can be, you know, for the home. And
Oh, definitely. But also too, it's like our relation to food and how you grew up with it. So for me, the microwave was a tool to make my access to food even that much more fast. So instead of having to, you know, on the back of the label, it always says if you want to put it in the oven, it'll take an hour, but if you want to put it in the microwave, it's like 5 minutes. Like I always choose microwave. So that was like a tool to just accelerate my ability to eat. Versus, I think at least from speaking personally, I've always been attracted to the idea of like growing our own vegetables or like having something even like in our apartment, but it's like more laborious and it'll require a lot more time and effort for a small yield. It's not like you're growing enough vegetables for the month. It's like growing enough vegetables for like how much you need. So I think the hurdle there is getting people of the mindset to switch how they view food, and it's not supposed to be always instant access, instant gratification, but instead, you know, it's a slow process, but you're getting something that's actually better for you in the long term.
yeah, speaking of the speed, so this whole podcast was sparked by the COVID, and when I was looking at the options of food security for myself, so growing vegetables is one of the option, and I realized I kind of in my apartment, like I live in a 4-room flat in Singapore, so I only have 92 square meters of livable space, and
Right.
I've calculated that if I were to, you know, cut myself off from the world, I will not last the first cycle of my growing time. So I need 30 days to grow the vegetable, and it's only enough for one meal
Exactly,
given the amount of
exactly.
space. Yeah.
Right.
But I've ventured into microgreens and sprouts. So those I can do it in under a week. But even those takes a week, you know? Like the seeds just need to sprout over, and that takes 4 days. But you can't be eating off sprouts entirely, you know. It's a very, like, it's nice, you know, like when you eat it once or twice. But once it's every day, like we had it, me and my wife were having it for 2 weeks straight, and now we just stop. I haven't touched the sprouting jar for the past few months already. It's just the texture don't really cut it as a daily, you know.
Yeah, it's more of like a garnish, right? Or
Yeah.
something you'd see on top, but not as the main base of your meal. And also, too, I think we're all visual, right? I mean, when we see something on the plate, we want to see portion size. We want to see depth. We want to see like something that looks hearty and delicious. So sprouts are quite delicate, dainty,
Yes.
and they don't even give you a full crunch into anything, right?
No, they don't.
But they're delicious. But you know, it's like funny. The joke is you have a whole bag of spinach and you put it to saute and it turns into like a handful.
Yeah.
Like it's just that's I think the rub that's going to be difficult for some people to transfer into being plant-based or at least flexitarian is just, you know, the portion size and actually just visually understanding, okay, like even though it's not like a big piece of steak, like this is good for me from a nutrition perspective. And you know, get your palate adjusted to that.
Yeah, I think palate adjustment is, I think, the biggest challenge for any food startup.
Completely, completely. And actually, if we go on that for a little bit, because that's why I think the companies here that are based in Singapore are really going to be the ones that are the front runners. Beyond Meat and Impossible, obviously, they've had almost a decade, right, to test the market, put out products. Beyond Meat's first product was chicken.
Oh, was
And
it?
you know, yeah, they've quietly removed that, but it didn't go well because the texture wasn't right. and it didn't really land with consumers, then their whole mission is to innovate, innovate, innovate. So if they realize something's not working, they'll take it out and try something new. And so that's when they came up with burger. So all the companies here have had the benefit of seeing the Beyond Meats and Impossibles of the world, what worked for them and what didn't, and they can apply it here to an Asian consumer's palate, because the people in Canada or France or whatever don't necessarily want to eat the same things as people based in Singapore, Indonesia, and Thailand. And so you have the benefit here of understanding, you know, the flavors and the ingredients and what will like really resonate here, I think, to make a really good product. And the biggest thing, though, is the availability of labor and the availability to scale it and manufacturing is cost way less. But I think they can move a lot faster.
Do you think, let's have a scenario. So if you have unlimited budget and talents, what would be a dream alternative protein that you would want to have?
I love that question. Because this industry is so young, you can really dream up anything. So I'm going to flip it. It wouldn't be a product. It would be an experience. So like we were talking about earlier with Star Trek, I truly envision one day where instead of going to like the butcher or your meat market, you'll literally go into like a lab, but it'll be obviously like more appealing for a consumer. And there'll be like 3D printers or bioreactors, and you can go in and customize the exact piece of meat you want, and it'll grow there for you, and you can purchase it right then and there. I think we'll move to a place where the way we interact with food will be completely different. Like I can even imagine like the produce section, instead of everything being bagged and packaged, that there's like just a vertical farm, and you go in and you tell the, you know, the sales clerk has like a bushel of kale, and they just chop, they clip it off the growing stalk. I really do see that kind of experience with food changing, and it's not so packaged and plastic and consumer-y processed anymore.
Yeah, I mean,
does that sound too crazy?
No, I mean, there are some Asian supermarkets in Asia that they started to go back to the old ways of packaging food. So they've been using banana leaves.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, so in Asia, a lot of parts of Asia, they use banana leaves. And so to a certain extent, some parts use paper, you know, like newspaper. Or you might even have it before those brown paper packaging where they put the food in, and inside there's sort of a...
I had that at the hawker stall when I did my to-go order. It was in the paper packaging, brown paper,
I saw this article, I can't remember where, but it was an American like an online magazine, and they were just talking about the marvel of this invention.
I will say I was fascinated. I know that sounds ridiculous, but it just felt so authentic and so simple is not the right word, but just so obvious that you could package your food this way. It doesn't have to be this like intricate plastic packaging with the bag and all the things you don't need. It was just exactly just like the food wrapped up in paper. I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, if you've ever been to Japan, like I had, I bought before stuff in Japan where there were just layers and layers and layers of plastics. As though they were, you know, covering some nuclear codes.
Yeah, and they're going to get in trouble now because, you know, as a company today, you have to think about so many different things. And one thing is packaging. Like, people don't want to see things heavily wrapped in plastic anymore. So, you know, your costs may go up a little bit because you have to find ingenious ways to package things in an eco-friendly way. But, but I do think when you're getting back to the basics, consumers appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, a daily rubbish clearing for my house, like half of it is plastic from the packaging. It's ridiculous.
I know. Also, we have a bad vice of getting a lot of bottled water, and that just contributes significantly to plastic waste. And, you know, especially too, we were watching this interesting documentary about the use of bottled water in Africa as well, because obviously like the water from the tap isn't clean enough, and so Nestle and a bunch of other huge water companies have totally infiltrated the market and push their plastic, you know, their bottled water. And so Nigeria, for instance, is just full of plastic because everyone's drinking all this bottled water and then chucking it in the rubbish, and it's a huge problem. So
Yeah, I mean in Indonesia as well, like a lot of them are. But for Singapore, like the water is quite clean though.
Water is very clean. I think, though, for me, I noticed a difference versus the US. I mean, I'm coming from New York, where I think we gave ourselves the title of having the best water, the best tap water, at least in the States. So here, I do notice a difference. It's like a lot more chlorinated here.
Yes.
So it's a little harder. Like I know, and I have a lot of friends who moved to Singapore as well too, who experienced this. Like the first month I moved here, my hair was falling out a lot because the water was just a lot harder. Yeah, so you have to get adjusted to it. But in terms of, I drink from the tap all the time. It's totally clean. It's just different taste.
Yeah, I mean, I myself, I have a filter. So I don't, I mean, I drink from the tap, but I don't drink directly. I put it in a filter. And ironically, like this, the brand I have, the filter is from America. It's called, I think, Berkey or something. So it's designed for places like Africa where you have dubious water source. And there's a difference though. Like now when I drink my filter water and the tap water, I can feel, I can taste the difference. Even my friends, yeah, my friends, they come over, they feel that there was a sweet taste from the filter rather than,
Really?
yeah.
Huh. Now I want to try the water you're having. That sounds delicious.
Yeah, I mean, what if we could meet up, I will pass it to you, no issues. And the thing is, this filter, like there's a lot of filters in Singapore, you know, like there's like thousands of brands, and this is the only one that doesn't need connection to the tap.
Oh,
Yeah, so
interesting.
it's like
So is
a
it like a you pour the water in it, like a standalone jug?
yep. It is designed for like you go to a war zone or you go to a disaster zone and you just pour water in.
Yeah. But we're
Yeah.
just in Singapore drinking it on like the balcony.
But it actually forced me to drink more water though. Like for some reason, because of the limited supply that I need to top it up all the time, like I actually drank more than when it's always available.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, that makes sense too, because especially like when we talk about taste, which is also a big hurdle that these alternative protein companies need to face. Taste is everything. So you can tell everyone that it's environmentally friendly and that it's like safe for animals and it's really good for your health. But if it tastes terrible, people aren't gonna buy it. And so I feel like that's been interesting to watch how these companies are iterating and trying new things to get the taste right. Or else it's just going to be, another company doing a tofurkey burger that no one cares about.
Yeah, I mean, like when Impossible did the whole cheeseburger campaign, I think it's a brilliant marketing idea, man. Like, if you could fool anyone into believing this is a real cheeseburger, you know, are
People
you
are mad about that, though,
really?
because people don't like to get duped. So there are some hardcore meat lovers who will be pissed if they find out that you gave them a plant-based burger and it wasn't actually meat.
What?
So yeah, actually, like talking about this, I've really been interested too, and I'll let you know when it's up. I'm putting together a regulatory, database about every country's stance on using the word meat for plant-based products, because that's really controversial right now, because some agencies feel like it's confusing for customers to call something meat, which they think is from an animal, if it's not.
Wow, yeah, I
So,
mean.
yeah, if you're like even Beyond Meat got in trouble because one, it says meat, but two, their logo is even like a cow. And so it's just people are like, I mean, people think that I think consumers are, they attribute them to what, like a sixth grade, seventh grade intelligence level. So they're saying that you'll get confused if you see that picture of a cow, you'll think it's meat, even though it clearly says like plant-based. So that's the problem that people are having is like, can you call it meat?
Oh, but for Asia it's fine. Like we have a vegetarian section and that's where it goes to.
I know, but you know how you said like it like where it's placed in the supermarket?
Yep.
Will people get confused if Beyond Meat's sitting right next to like an actual steak?
Yeah, that was one of their vision, right? To be next to a real meat.
Exactly. Yeah, which I think is smart because you need to educate people that this is exactly a one-to-one replacement for meat. at the same time, I do think people are now like, well, it's confusing. It's like, it's not meat. So.
But it tastes like meat.
It tastes like meat.
It even
really
smells
does.
Like meat, though.
Have you tried Omnipork?
No, I don't believe we have it in Singapore yet.
No, we do. We do. They have it at Little Farms. And there's one more place you can buy it. Yeah, but you can buy it. And it's actually really cheap.
Right.
And quite easy to cook up. It's ground pork. But then also they have like all these different product lines now. Like they have luncheon meat, they have ready to made like frozen food. So they're really expanding it. I think they have dumplings as well that they're selling in Taiwan. That have been like really popular. Like
dumplings.
Pork dumplings.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I need to try that then. So Little Farm, eh? So okay, I'll go and get around to buy one.
Yeah, Little Farms is the best. They have so many different, they have Beyond ground beef meat there. They have Beyond sausage and they have Omni pork. I think Cold Storage may have it. Cold Storage definitely has Beyond meat and they have that brand Corn, Q-U-O-R-N, which is really good.
Yep. I've seen that, but Corn don't really have the meat look. Like it still looks very, you know, plant-based.
Oh yeah, 100%. And that, because that's also an older company, it's been around for a while. So I think the new, like, people will see the trend now is plant-based companies are really trying to give you a complete replica of meat, no question in your mind that it's meat unless you know.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you compare it to the previous products on the market, it's like, okay, here's like a plant-based veggie burger, but it's like cardboardy, it doesn't look that appealing. So it's the same. But the Corn products, even though the chicken nuggets don't really look like it, it's actually pretty good.
That I'll have to try as well.
Just eating too much here in Singapore.
All right. So maybe I think we could end off here. I mean, I have a blast talking to you regarding all the stuff that we talk about. The introduction to alternative protein, the companies, and even your experience here as a New Yorker coming to Singapore. You know, all your different experience. Maybe in the future, if there's another opportunity, I would like to come back and maybe talk a bit more about the stuff that you already had chance to, you know, kind of interact with and your time as a mentor in the big ideas ventures. I mean, you are still doing that, right, at the moment?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I would love to come back. This was such a fun conversation, and I'm really happy that you're being a voice and a leader here in Singapore to discuss these issues, because I think once people are aware that these products are out there and the benefits for them, it'll rocket ship in terms of success.
I mean, I'm just a voice. I haven't reached the leader part yet.
I'm saying you're a leader. Yeah. And two, just like for all your listeners as well, you know, everyone individually can have an impact. It might seem like you have to be a government leader, or, you know, an investor to really make change. But even what you choose to buy at the supermarket has ripple effects. So if everyone's going out there and buying Beyond Meat, that'll signal to like Cold Storage or Fair Price that, hey, we need to stock more of this. Maybe there's an interest for more plant-based products. So, you know, if you don't see something in your supermarkets that you want, like almond milk, I notice is sometimes hard to find here, like dairy-free Beyond Soy.
Yes.
You know, just ask the manager of the store, hey, can you guys start stocking this? They'll take note of that. And, you know, where there's spending power, there's going to be attention given to it.
All right. So thank you very much. And so we'll see everyone soon. Yeah, thank you for listening to the Functional Food Podcast, and you know, stay safe.
Bye everyone.
Bye, Jackie.